To me, that causes awe and wonder. You know, just to look in the eye of a whale and ask, you know, where has she been? And what does she see when she dives, you know, a kilometer into the depths to hunt? So I try with my photography, Eric, to bring back a little bit of that awe and wonder. The oil, the plastic companies, they have PR agencies, they have marketing departments, but the whales don't, the fish don't. Somebody needs to speak on their behalf.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure, this is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
Hi, and welcome to a new episode of Unfolding Maps. And to kick this one off, I'd like to ask you to imagine this scene with me. Imagine a giant whale shark gracefully swimming beneath a fishing boat, its massive form capable of capsizing the small vessel with a single movement. This is one of those captivating moments that our guest today in this episode is regularly capturing. And maybe some of you are familiar with her. She is pretty well known. I'm talking about the renowned Mexican environmental photographer and marine biologist Cristina Mittermeier. And we here at our team, we are very excited about this interview because Cristina has been on our guest wish list for a long time. Miriam, our editor, she was very excited to get Cristina onto our show, has been working towards this for months. So I hope you, the listeners, are just as happy as we are. I'm sure you will be. And whether it's majestic whales, gigantic icebergs, or indigenous people, Cristina has traveled the whole world, and she's done so for decades now, to capture the beauty and fragility of Earth's biodiversity and to document the wisdom of those who honor and respect nature. And we will talk about all of this in this wide-ranging conversation. Her photography serves as a compelling call to action, and it illustrates the transformative power of photography in raising awareness and inspiring change. Her work has established her as one of the most influential conservation photographers of our time, and I'm talking worldwide. She has really made an impact. And together with her husband, Paul Nicklin, who is also a really well-known and accomplished photographer, she co-founded the nonprofit organization Sea Legacy. And this organization is dedicated to promoting climate action and sustainable solutions by supporting scientific endeavors and conservation strategies. Sounds a little bit complicated, but I promise you we will get into all of this in a second. Cristina's work has been featured in numerous prestigious publications, including the National Geographic magazine and Time. And with her new book, Hope, I totally recommend you check it out. It's beautiful. With this new book, she aims to convey hope, which she herself finds in the deep connection between humanity and nature. Have fun with this conversation. Enjoy. Hi, Cristina. Welcome to our show. Thank you so much for making the time. Hi.
Thank you, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here.
And first off, I hope we won't be interrupted. Just for information, we had an earthquake here in New York just an hour ago, 4.8. I don't know if you already read about it in the news.
Friend
but
told
everything
me
was shaking. So I hope we are fine right now.
Yes, but if not, you know what to do, right?
Exactly. I know. Yes. Where are you right now? Where in the world?
I'm just south of you. I'm in Washington, D.C., and I'm here for a bunch of very exciting events around climate, around the plastics treaty. So very good. Mm-hmm.
Okay, nice. Yeah. So you are working like most of the times, at least that's my sense, and me too, when I'm not surprised by an earthquake. And I have to say today this experience, it was not a severe earthquake, but it was the heaviest I experienced. It brought home the power of nature. And of course, nature can be powerful, nature can be beautiful, it can sometimes be scary. And all of this, of course, is also reflected in your work to different degrees. That's why I suggest to jump straight into your work. There's a lot to talk about. And I'd like to start with a photo that you took a while ago of a sea lion diving next to countless red fish. I'm sending it over to you here via Zoom right now. And it looks absolutely beautiful. The colors, the air bubbles surrounding these animals. Can you tell us a little bit about this particular photo? Where and how did you take it?
Yes. First, I want to comment a little bit on, you know, this feeling that Mother Nature is very powerful and that when you experience something like an earthquake or the upcoming solar eclipse, it makes you really feel small. You know, humans are so vulnerable and we live in this fragile little planet and sometimes we forget. And so I think it's good that we get these reminders that we are really at the mercy of nature. And it's in our best interest to be good to Mother Nature.
And I think the beautiful thing about that fact that you are mentioning is this can be, of course, in some situations a little bit scary because it just shows us how comparably insignificant we are, which I think can, as you indicated, be a positive thing. But that is also the precise thing that also can make us feel really free, right? If we go into a vast, impressive landscape and we feel so small and insignificant, then this very power of nature can also be really liberating.
So true. So true. So let me tell you about this photograph.
Yeah.
It was an image that was taken in the Galapagos National Marine Park.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the image that became kind of an iconic representation of the efforts that were being made by Ecuador, where the Galapagos is, but other countries as well, to protect more marine protection around these islands and to create the first interconnected international swimway. So I was there with Sea Legacy, my organization, and we were supporting the government of Panama, Costa Rica, Colombia, and Ecuador in their efforts to gain public support so that they could create these expansions to their marine protections. Because you have to remember that for everyone that's trying to create marine protections, there's also somebody that's lobbying for more fishing freedom. So there's always
this
friction.
I mean, that's the whole challenge, right?
That's right. Yeah. So this image was taken on a remote island, and it was a lot of work. It was not an easy image to take because there's a lot of search. The ocean was very agitated, and there were Galapagos sharks all around me. Of course, the Galapagos sharks were interested in the sea lion, not on me, but, you know, they're not asking questions, so you have to keep an eye.
You're mentioning the search, and I have to say the whole picture looks so dynamic. It looks like a whirlwind of energy, of bright colors, as I said before, but also this powerful water. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, you have to be careful, you know, watch your back that animals are not, you know, surprising you from behind. But you also have to watch the power of the waves because these ocean surge can be tremendously powerful and it wants to crash you against the rock. You have an expensive camera in your hand, you have a scuba tank in your back. So there's a lot to think about.
Is that sometimes difficult for you to not get lost in the moment?
Oh, yeah. I think that's the number one skill set of a camera person underwater is that you can get tunnel vision and you can forget that you're underwater. And you need to keep track of important things like how much air is left in your tank, how deep have you sank, where are your teammates, you know, all of these things.
We'll get into your organization, Sea Legacy, a little bit later. But since you mentioned that you were at the Galapagos to support these governments in setting up like a marine, what was the right phrase? How did you phrase
International
it?
Marine Swimway.
Yeah, okay. How did you help them in that effort?
Because you have to remember that our governments, our elected politicians, really rely on the votes of the people. So they need public support in order to enact legislation.
Yeah.
So Sea Legacy comes in and oftentimes we help translate the science for the general public, especially to say, you know, these marine protections are important and the government needs support. They need to hear from the public.
And even government itself, but of course, there's always different fractions in governments, right? Or the opposition. There are green parties, there are parties that are not as interested and passionate about nature. So you want to support the right voices with this kind of visual storytelling, I guess.
That's right. And in all governments, my experience is that the people with the loudest voice, the ones that scream the loudest, are the ones that get their way. So we need to make sure that we're the ones that are screaming for nature.
Yeah. And this is, as I said, a really beautiful, powerful, colorful scream. But sometimes, of course, you and your photos, they scream in a different way. I remember a photo that you took. It's iconic by now in a sad sense. A photo that you took all the way back in 2017 when you and your husband, Paul Nicklin, were traveling. And you captured, in a saddening and shocking way, a polar bear at its final stages of life. It looked weak. It's shedding its fur. It looks like it's gonna starve in a matter of hours or minutes. And that photo back then went viral. I believe it reached over 2.5 billion people worldwide. Maybe some of our listeners have seen it back then. How do you manage in your work? How do you manage the balance between portraying reality, which can be beautiful, but also can be really frightening and saddening given what's going on, and also maintaining a powerful and hopeful message?
It really comes down to storytelling. And the best storytellers in history know that the most important thing you can do for a story is to start with the dream. Dr. Martin Luther King did it for the civil rights. You know, he reminded us that we have a dream, but we have a lot of work to do to get there. Because if you lead with the apocalyptic gloom and doom, the reality, everything that's scary, people tend to get demoralized and people become disillusioned very fast and apathetic. Yeah. So it's a matter of really rallying the best of our instincts for hope and for optimism. And we do that through photography.
That's really interesting to me that you're saying like apathy is a danger because, yeah, as I said before, in 2017, this photo had a huge impact. So you could say in that sense, it was a massive success. But at the other hand, I feel, and maybe that's just happened in a few years in between then and now, I feel you can correct me if you are more experienced and you talk to more people, but if you show people a photo of a starving polar bear today, some of them will just roll their eyes and be like, oh, okay, I've seen that a million times now. Basically, they feel, yeah, sure, climate change, whatever. Maybe they even deny it, hopefully not as much anymore because we have read so many studies and whatever. But even with the people who believe in climate change and are actually empathetic with animals, there is a danger of climate change fatigue and they can't be bothered to, or they just can't manage even to feel emotions anymore when they see stuff like this.
You're so correct. You're absolutely right. And that's why we show the images of what's beautiful and what's possible. Mm-hmm. If we do the hard work of actually rallying for protection and then remind people that if we don't, you know, this is the reality we're going to face. And we can try, you know, we can have climate fatigue. We can be apathetic, but it's going to come for us. You know, I know that the survivors, the best generals in battle are not the ones that sit down and wait for the enemy to come and kill them. You know, they're the ones that get up and actually fight. And so I feel that hope is a very powerful motivator to keep us in the fight and to keep us hopeful. And you have to remember, Eric, that like I said before, you know, the people who scream the loudest, the people that have the microphone, the ones that are telling the story are the ones that get history in the end. And you would believe that the environmental movement has a bigger microphone, but no, the fossil fuel industry has a bigger microphone and they would like you to believe that everything's going to be okay. I can tell you that it's not.
So we need to be striving for a balance between being truthful, but also remain aspirational, reaching for a bigger goal, a larger,
What kind of planet do we want to live in, you know?
And you mentioned hope. I want to come back to this in a minute, but just one more question about your photography itself. In your mind, I don't even know if that is even possible or if it makes sense to ask this question this way, but what would you say distinguishes simply taking photos of nature from really using images to advocate for nature conservation, which is what you have been doing? There are many nature photographers, but you managed to really turn this photography into a weapon, maybe sounds so negative, a tool, a powerful tool. How do you approach, how do you think about this when you are out there to try to capture these moments?
I had a revelation when I was beginning my career as a photographer because, yes, there were a lot of photographers who were out there taking pictures. Felt to me, you know, the same bear, the same eagle. They were just in a line all trying to get the awards. And I was seeing that many of them were not doing really very much to even explain what is it that they were photographing or what the situation was. But there were a handful of photographers that were taking their images and they were using them as almost as flags to rally for protection, conservation. Photographer Michael Nick Nichols from National Geographic is one that comes to mind. He did the mega transect for National Geographic magazine.
What is that? Can you explain that? My English is failing me.
He hiked 2,000 miles from the highlands of Cameroon all the way to the beaches of Gabon, following the trails made by forest elephants. These trails where no human had ever walked before. Yeah. And then he used the images from that project, the mega transect, and he took him to the president of Gabon, President Bongo. And together they created 13 new national parks. But those national parks don't create themselves on their own. They need champions. They need people that explain, that are passionate, that are, you know, willing to actually do the work of being an activist and an advocate, which is what I want my photography to do.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a step further from what you said, these nature photos that are more like eyeing towards the photography awards, because they're aesthetically really beautiful and maybe even masterfully done. But in your work, that is not enough. You are looking for a story and you're looking for context to help people understand what's going on.
I'm willing to take those photographs and actually do the hard work of taking them in person to explain to the people that make the decisions why this is important.
And to help them in this way too. Yeah, to remain hopeful. We talked about it before, the topic of hope. And actually, this is the very title of your new book, Hope. Can you tell us a little bit about that project? What is it about?
Yeah, you know, I am not immune to feeling a little discouraged every once and again. You know, the news are mostly terrible, and the state of our planet seems to be getting worse and worse. And so it becomes hard sometimes to be hopeful and to be optimistic. And I feel like a huge part of my job is to inspire others and give hope to others. And sometimes I find it even hard for myself. No. So I started this project, Hope, because I know that remaining hopeful is a choice. I make the choice every day. Am I going to give up, or am I going to dig in and keep working, keep fighting? And this book is a representation of my career as a photographer and all the incredible people and wildlife and amazing situations that I have found myself in that still give me hope and that still give me a reason to keep fighting and trying. And so I do it for myself, Eric, as much as I do it for everybody else. But I hope that by creating this book, it becomes a daily reminder of the reasons why it matters and why we need to keep fighting.
Some of what you saying about the importance of hope that you're trying to support with this work reminds me of the conversations I had for the show with Jane Goodall, who of course also talks a lot about hope and of the importance of not losing hope. And I feel it's helpful for people to hear you talk about that very topic in such a reflective way, because as you said, people are looking for you. They're looking towards you in the search of hope. They want to gain hope from you because you are an inspirational person with inspirational work. But it's also important, I think, to hear, and that's why it's great that you're that honest, that it's not easy all the time for you. So there's a reality check, and it's not you're not blindly hopeful or naive even. No, you see what's going on. You are visiting all these places. You know more about the change and the negative changes than most of us. And yet again, you make the decision to stay hopeful. So just find this very empowering, because if you are able to remain hopeful and to keep fighting, then I think few of us should have a good reason to give up hope.
So true. And, you know, I look at somebody like Jane Goodall, and she just turned 90 yesterday. And I think about the lifelong sacrifice she's made to be an advocate for wildlife. All the things that she gave up in order to fight for the things that she believes in. And she's still doing it at 90. And here we have, you know, a lot of people that have never cared or have given up. And it seems very unfair. And so I don't want to be one of those people. I want to be more like Jane Goodall.
Don't we all want to be more like Jane Goodall? But of course, there are so many great stories in the book. So I encourage everyone to read it, from your work all over the world. Very heavily focused, of course, on nature in terms of the stories and the photography. One photo that I just took out from there for the purpose of this conversation, I'm sending it to you here via Zoom. It doesn't show nature itself. It doesn't show like a forest or anything like that. No, it shows a very beautiful woman, a lady who gazes directly into the camera. She wears pearl jewelry. Her face is painted red and purple. Can you tell us about that photo, about that woman?
Yeah, a lot of my photography has been a recognition that nature doesn't exist in isolation. Humans live with nature, and some humans, especially indigenous people, live really closely with nature. And
ideally, they're even part of it, right?
They depend on biodiversity. And indigenous people in many places are the stewards and the guardians of that biodiversity. And in places like the Amazon, where this photograph was taken, It is thanks to indigenous people that there's still pockets of wilderness left because they're protecting it. And they're protecting these places with their bows and arrows, you know, against the bulldozers. It really is a modern day avatar. And in these villages, which are never very large, they're oftentimes, you know, 150, 200 people. They're very small and people are very vulnerable. There's no clinic. There's no school. There's no hospital. People really do depend on each other to survive. The women play such an important role. The recognition of the matriarchy, the knowledge that's carried by the elders. And I feel like in our modern Western societies, we tend to disregard the knowledge of elders and disregard the knowledge of indigenous people because we're arrogant and because we think that we know it all. But the truth of the matter is that in order to survive on this very fragile planet, we really need to lean into what people that are wiser and older than we are know about how to restore the health on planet Earth. So I love photographs like this, a matriarch, an elder, a woman who's been on this planet for so long. I like to say that indigenous people are the last people connected to the operating system of planet Earth, and we need to listen to them.
I don't want to sound too cheesy, but what kind of hope did you find with these people? You talked about witnessing how they fight against these bulldozers and against land grabbing and all of that with their bows and arrows. That could also be very sad and almost depressing to see, see this almost senseless fight.
Oh, my work can be really hard and can be really depressing, but I tell you where I find the hope, because being a certain way is a personal choice. Mm-hmm. You know, being a mindful human being, somebody who cares, somebody who's in tune with the fact that we depend on a healthy planet to survive, it's a choice. You know, people like Elon Musk, well, he wants to go to Mars, and I wish him the best of luck. For the rest of us who's staying on this planet, we're going to need nature. And it's very arrogant and blind to even dream that we can survive just in cities and that we don't need nature at all. So indigenous people teach us that there's a different way of seeing ourselves as citizens of planet Earth, almost as passengers of a spaceship that's traveling across the universe. And imagine for a second, Eric, that you were going to go to Mars with Elon Musk. The first thing that you would do when you board his spaceship is you would learn everything about it. Where does the water come from? How do I take care of it? Because it needs to last my entire journey across the universe. Mm-hmm. But here we are on Spaceship Earth and we know nothing about how it works. And we've mistreated it, abused, profiteered from it, selfishly destroying it. But there's other people, you know, indigenous people that have been living in harmony with nature for generations. What can we learn from them about a way of being?
It's a fascinating point you're making, especially because just a few weeks, a month ago, I talked for our German show, Weltwach, with an astronaut who is a huge fan of the idea of space exploration and space tourism. And he loves what's going on with with regard...
We will be waving from Earth. Goodbye.
With regard to Elon Musk and people like that.
Yeah.
But I absolutely agree with you in that regard, that it is much more worthwhile to not look for billionaires like Elon and others in terms of role models or even heroes, as some perceive them, but to people like this Kayapo elderly lady from the Amazon, who show us many things that are much more important for us today to deal with our challenges today. We don't need only technology. That can be maybe a small part of it, but it won't be the ultimate solution and often has been the opposite of a solution. It has made things worse. So there's a different thing that we can and should learn, I believe. And you are making that very point in your work. I believe you have coined a term, or at least you love to use it, enoughness. It's also the name of an exhibition you're doing right now in Italy. Is that a word that in some sense derived from your experiences and insights that you gained in these places like the Amazon?
Because, you know, as humans, we, especially in the Western world, we are indoctrinated by society, by school, by media, onto, you know, how we should aspire to have certain things. Mm-hmm. And if you don't own a car and a house and a pair of Prada, whatever, you know, you feel like you are lacking something. When you spend time with indigenous people, you can see clearly that they don't have the same type of material wealth. And sometimes they live in what we would call poverty. But they have a wealth of other things that are so much more valuable. The pride in language and tradition and custom and ritual and community and friendship and meaningful work. I mean, these are things that are valuable to humans because it's what makes you happy in the end.
Yeah.
So for me, it became very clear that having a very clear understanding of how much is enough for me, how much do I need? So instead of subscribing to the idea that I'm going to be on a rat race to make more, more, more every day, because it's a never-ending hole. You know, you're never going to fill it. Just know how much is enough. And once you have that sense of enoughness, you can say no to so many things that are frivolous and useless and consumeristic, and you don't even miss them. You know, it's so easy to have enough.
How do you manage to make that decision or to find that ability to remove yourself from these, well, expectations by society or whatever? What I'm trying to say is it's not that easy for many people to have that real sense of self where they know this actually doesn't really make me happy. Certain developments, marketing firms, whatever, they want me to believe that I need this and I love it. But actually what really is at the core of it is something else. And right now, this is enough. Was that a way for you, or were you always able to just listen to yourself and know what you truly need to find the happiness that you're looking for?
It was a realization because I lived in the United States for many times, and the United States is infected with this virus of, you know, greed and consumerism and marketing. And it's almost stupid, you know, that you have to buy all these things and always for the price of one, we give you a second one. I mean, you constantly bombarded and I was finding myself like that. Whenever I felt sad or lonely or angry, go shopping. You know, that'll make you feel better.
Yeah.
And it really took a lot of effort to take a very good look at myself to ask, you know, is this really what's going to make me happy? What's going to make my life feel fulfilled? And you start realizing that that's not it. So then what is it? And it's different for all of us. I cannot tell you what's going to be enough for you. But I will say this, you know, I rediscovered my pride in being Mexican and understanding more about my culture and looking back into my own indigenous roots and being proud of that. Or, you know, just trying to meet more of my family and learn where they came from and who they are. I mean, these things are what fills you with love and joy. And you know what else, Eric? Doing for others. Being generous, being kind, just fills you with joy. And so, yeah, everybody's different. So find what makes you enough.
Yeah, that's a beautiful message. And it is part of your message in the book Hope. And when we talk about this lady from the Amazon, that already indicates that your spectrum of topics is pretty broad. But of course, you have one great passion, maybe your greatest passion, which is, I believe, underwater photography. And we talked about it in the beginning with the sea lion and the Galapagos Islands. And that's probably no surprise considering you're a marine biologist, so you have a background in that area. Why do you love the ocean so much? What do you associate with the ocean? Why is that such a big part of your personal enough?
Because if you live on planet Earth and you've ever looked at the globe, you realize very quickly that it's 70% of our planet. So it's the biggest ecosystem. So if you want to understand more about your planet, well, you need to start with the ocean. And the truth of the matter is, we have ignored and neglected the ocean for a long time. It's a very mysterious place. It's a place where a lot of people are frightened. And we know more about space and about other planets than we know about the depths of our own sea. And yet it's the ecosystem that keeps us alive. We forget that 50% of the oxygen we require to survive is generated by the ocean. And it's not a mechanical process. It's a biological process. The phytoplankton, you know, these microscopic rainforest in the ocean. Is what's it's exhaling the oxygen, and it's also inhaling the excess carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Incredibly important, but it's invisible, so we don't see it. It's estimated that we've already lost the equivalent of 4 Amazon rainforests worth of phytoplankton. Well, I don't know anybody who can hold their breath for half the time. So we better pay attention and study and learn and protect the ocean and really err on the precautionary principle. Because it's what keeps us alive. And Elon in his spaceship going to Mars or wherever he's going, he's going to need to take every breath of air and every sip of water and every bit of soil from this planet because it's the only place in the universe where it's found. And we squander it. We neglect it. We destroy it. It's I almost think, you know, it's imagine that you were flying from Germany to the United States and there's a crazy man in economy and he's got an axe, you know, and he's axing at the airplane, but you're sitting in first class, so you don't care. Until he makes a hole in the fuselage, and then we have a problem. Like, we have to care.
Yeah, but I mean, you're describing why it is so difficult, because the ocean is a realm of the, positively speaking, of the mysterious, negatively speaking, of the unknown, the unseen to many of us. It's just hard to get people excited and interested about something that most of them cannot really visit, do not really understand, and do not really ever see. We all have seen the surface, of course, but somehow it's, yeah, I don't know why. It's easier for us, it seems like, to relate to the rainforest, for example. I mean, even the rainforest, unfortunately, as we all know, is being destroyed continuously, but it's on everybody's mind. And there are so many beautiful underwater documentary films. We know how beautiful stuff is that is going on there, and still, yeah, it has been really difficult to get the same kind of momentum for curiosity and protection with regard to the ocean. Why is that?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Well, I think partially it's because we have this innate fear of the mystery of what we don't know. Hmm. And we have this fascination with creatures like sharks that are scary to so many people. Yeah, it's been difficult to generate the interest. But I tell people, if we really were a spaceship and you open up the trunk of the car where the engine is, it would be all salt water. That's the generator of life on planet Earth. 80% of biodiversity lives in the ocean. And it's such an engine for the economy. It creates enormous amount of, you know, protein wealth for communities in the coast. And it also protects us from, you know, extreme changes in temperature. It has a buffering effect. It's just such an important part. Like, you don't need to understand it. Just know that you have to protect it. And it starts with the choices we make on the food we eat, because what's being put in a menu, we don't even know where that fish comes from. You know, what atrocities have been committed to put it on our plate. So order the pasta, eat something else, you know?
Yeah, be mindful of your consumption. That's, of course, a very important part. Was that realization of the huge importance of the oceanic world, was that one of the main reasons for you to become a marine biologist?
No.
Were you already that knowledgeable all the way back then? Or was it more about the prettiness of the colorful fish? I don't know what it was.
It was, of course. You know, I was a 16-year-old girl going to university and I just wanted to see dolphins. Yeah, but I spent 4 years in university looking at the ocean through a microscope, and it really is a microscopic broth that's alive. And it's amazing, but we don't understand it, right? We just think about the beach. So I try with my photography, Eric, to bring back a little bit of that awe and wonder and maybe explain a little bit of how it works. You know, we know very little. I was just learning that the largest migration on planet Earth happens in the ocean, and it happens every night. I'm going to be anchoring this solar eclipse event that we're having here in North America.
In a few days, right?
Yeah,
we're recording
this
in the beginning of April 2024. So I believe it's happening soon.
April the 8th, coming up. Yeah, Tuesday. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm going to be talking about the effect that the astrological reality of planet Earth has on animals here. The moon, the sun, the stars has enormous influence on the behavior of animals and the things that we see on this planet. And it's all connected.
How did you go from marine biology and science, you talked about spending a lot of time at the microscope, to focusing more on photography and conservation in a broader sense?
It's just frustration, because most people have no interest in learning about the science, and speaking in data and graphics to most people doesn't elicit any emotion or care. But I accidentally discovered that photography is a universal language that a lot of people love, and they have curiosity. They want to know how an image was made. They want to know how it felt like to be there. Were you scared? Were you cold? Were you hungry? And those are human questions. So when somebody asks you a question, you've already broken the ice and you already started a dialogue. And that's the first step into getting anybody into having a common point of view with you. That's why storytelling is so important.
Do you see yourself today more as a photographer or a biologist or an activist or a storyteller or a journalist? How do you think about yourself and the work that you're doing?
I think all of the above. I mean, and those are just things that I do. I really... You know, Eric, I really think of myself as a human being, and humans only exist on planet Earth. And so I am a citizen of this planet, and I feel very strongly that I should be very careful with how I treat my planet.
And you're not only careful, you're also very energetic. You're doing a lot. You're not just taking all these photos all over the world, but you have founded, we have briefly mentioned it already, you have founded this organization, the NGO Sea Legacy, quite a few years ago. You did that together with your husband, Paul Nicklin, and with Andy Mann. I would love to talk about your work in this amazing organization. Why don't you start? Like, what's the purpose? What's the vision and the mission of Sea Legacy?
Oh, it's a wonderful question, Eric. Thank you. Because Sea Legacy gives me hope. Mm-hmm. Paul and I and Andy, we all were working for National Geographic magazine. And at the time, I really believed that it was like a very large microphone that would allow me to, you know, share with others my enthusiasm and my love for nature. And then, you know, it started changing and it became more and more difficult to have that editorial voice as a photographer. So we started Sea Legacy at the same time that social media started. Oh, it was so refreshing to have all these followers that were commenting and liking and asking questions on our Instagram. Because for a few years there, I really thought, you know, this is it. We can share the stories every day. People are curious. They want to know. We can, you know, raise awareness, educate, activate people to do more. And then, of course, Meta started making us pay and the algorithm, and now people don't get to see your content.
Okay. So that's what you mean with you thought for a while, this is it. You felt this huge momentum because with your amazing work, you are in the right place at the right time, and you gathered reach far beyond probably what you ever did with National Geographic in a relatively short amount of time. And you got a lot of engagement and interaction. And so you thought, wow, we are creating a movement here. This is amazing. There are so many of us.
It felt like that. You know, there's still a very core group of people that still follow our work of Sea Legacy. And we have grown a lot. Did you know that Sea Legacy partners with over 150 other organizations, from the coral gardeners to scientists in Antarctica? We help translate the science for the public. And we do it with photography. We do it with video, with stories. And it's a lot of fun, you know, to be the loudspeaker for so many amazing individuals. They're heroes, really, in the front lines. And they're holding the tsunami of change on plastic pollution and fisheries and all these things. And they're doing amazing work. And I think that sharing those stories is reason for hope. There are so many people who have not given up yet, and they're trying the best they can, and they're doing amazing, heroic things.
And you want to give them visibility by working with them, by documenting their work and making it accessible to more people.
Yeah, we make the invisible visible and we make it shine. And so we're working with, we just went to New Zealand and I was pretty shocked, Eric, because New Zealand is a country that's an island nation. Mm-hmm. 93% of their territory is ocean. But you know how much they've protected? 0.3%, almost nothing.
Wow, that's surprising to me. I didn't know that.
Shocking and embarrassing, right? So yeah. They have bottom trawlers, you know, trawling the bottom of the ocean, and they are removing the predators on the top of the food chain, all the snappers. In every restaurant, even in Air New Zealand, they serve snapper everywhere. So what ends up
that's
happening
kind of
is,
fish, yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. Now the urchins are out of control and they're eating the kelp forest. I mean, New Zealand is going to pay a huge price for this. And amidst all of these people who don't care, you find a small group, and they're called the Young Ocean Explorers. And they teach children about the ocean, and they ignite that spark of, you know, that was ignited in me when I was a child, of wonder about the ocean creatures. And so they reach 400,000 kids in New Zealand with school mm-hmm. programs about the ocean. Well, we want to make the Young Ocean Explorers shine. You know, we go out with them, we tell their stories, we share. And they're so grateful.
That is great, yeah. Yeah, I've heard you describe this organization somewhere else as a kind of marketing agency for the ocean, which could lead to mild irritation, like marketing agency. That doesn't sound like very positive for most people. But of course, it just indicates you really try to create content, visuals, and stories that appeal to as many people as the latest, I don't know, McDonald's ad campaign.
That's so true.
Does. You just want to optimize for impact, right? That's how I understand it.
So true.
And
I mean,
the kind of impact that we urgently need.
You know, we oftentimes argue with corporations that are, you know, either they don't know better or they don't care. You know, the oil companies, the plastic companies, they have PR agencies, they have marketing departments, but the whales don't, the fish don't. Somebody needs to speak on their behalf.
So when you argue with these oil companies, for example, I also know that you work with sometimes even presidents or ministers, like politicians of all different kinds. How does that work? Like, I ask it in a very naive way. So do you go somewhere like, let's say, a turtle scientist, you document her work in the ocean, create beautiful photos, post them, and then there's some engagement on Instagram? Or how does it work? How do you do your advocacy when it comes to the more political and even like economical realm?
That's a very excellent question you ask. You know, when you've been doing this for a long time, like I have, you do have a lot of relationships. And at the end of the day, it does come to the organizations that we work with, because they're the ones that have those relationships with the local politicians. But there's something amazing about being a photographer that opens a lot of doors. You know, the minister of this and that wants to meet with a National Geographic photographer. They want you to come over to their office and show some pictures. And that opens up the opportunity for you to share why things are important. And you just have to remember that a lot of the politicians, you know, they're elected not because they're biologists. They might know nothing about how things work. So they want to know, they want to be educated. And once they realize that something matters and it's important, and when they realize that they can do something about it, oftentimes they do. And it happens very fast. And so I call it ocean diplomacy. And it's about...
That's a good word.
It's about using the tools that we have, you know, the books, the exhibits, the presentations, to engage with the people that have the power to make decisions, but they didn't know that they had that power.
It's probably very hard to quantify because minds are being changed bit by bit, step by step, and policies originate from many different influences. Is there any like outcome that you would say you are happy about or proud of from these conversations that you've had?
So it happens all the time. Happens all the time. It's very difficult to quantify. You're right. Yeah. We try to come up with what they call KPIs, the key performance indicators.
You talk like a marketing agency, but it's necessary, I guess.
In our field, it's very difficult because sometimes these conservation advocacy campaigns last 20 years. So I'll give you an example. In 2006, Paul Nicklin went as a National Geographic photographer to the South Sandwich and South Georgia Islands, which is subantarctic. It's one of the most beautiful places on Earth. And you have these abundance of wildlife, penguins and elephant seals and the albatross. I mean, all these incredible animals. It's the most biodense place on the planet. And it was not protected. You know, the islands had a tiny little protection, like a donut around them. But when you start realizing that all of these creatures rely on krill, which is at the bottom of the food chain, well, I mean, the entire ecosystem in Antarctica. And of course, you have all these fishing vessels coming in from China and Norway and all the parts of the world to suction out the krill so that we can take omega-3 and that we can feed our salmon, the farms, right?
Yeah.
And it took a long time, just the advocacy, the conversations, attending the events, talking to the minister. Oh, there's a new minister. You have to go talk to the minister. It's ongoing. But after 20 years, working with many other partners, amazing champions, you know, Sylvia Earle and Pew Bertarelli and all these other organizations, they finally declared a great expansion, 65,000 additional square kilometers of protection in these two islands. And it's taken so long that you almost feel like you can't celebrate, you know?
Yeah.
But it is worth celebrating.
Absolutely. That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah. And of course, yeah, having this kind of great protected habitat is amazing for the biodiversity in these places. It also costs a lot of political power, willpower to accomplish this, and also money. And one of the other interviews I listened to and read in preparation for this, I believe this one was at Bloomberg TV. I'm not sure about the numbers, but you get into the topic of the fact that we just need more money in terms of the oceans. You talk about investment, and as I said, I forgot the numbers, but
I can tell you the numbers, Eric.
Yeah, talk about it, because I'm curious about that. Like, how do we invest? What do we invest? Who do we want to invest in the ocean? How does that part work?
Yeah, I mean, think about this for a second. There's not a single country on planet Earth that lists the ocean or its coastline as one of their assets. It's not something you can quantify or put an economic value or insure. And yet, you know, it's an incredibly valuable thing. So we need to change that mindset. When it comes to the investments in creating the technologies and the protections, the United Nations estimates that the blue economy is going to require $170 billion in investment every year. And this is for shipping, for fisheries, you know, to do things right. You know how much we have at the moment? $20 billion. I mean, it's the gap is enormous, right?
Yeah.
But it's
and
changing.
You said this money would be needed, to repeat what you said, to do things right. So basically to transform this whole industry, or many industries, in fact, into a more sustainable way of operating.
That's right. You know, if you wanted to have really sewage plants and control of plastics, I mean, the whole gamut of activities that revolve around the ocean. And on the philanthropy side, because it requires a lot of donations, right, to do the advocacy work, the people that are protecting the sea turtles and the sharks, all of it takes money.
Yeah.
Did you know that the investments that we make as charitable donations, only 2% goes to the environment, 30% goes to religion, and then we invest in education, in art, in health, you know, at the very bottom. 1.8% goes to environment.
Overall, so you mean like money that people or organizations donate for quote-unquote good causes? Very little goes to nature. Okay.
So somehow we have to, I mean, I don't want people to stop donating to the things that they care about, of course.
Yeah.
But we need to over-bias for the environment. We need to increase our charity for environment, because environment includes climate change, the ocean, all of wildlife, all of extinction, and it is all underfunded.
Yeah.
So where do I find hope? I find hope in that there's millions of people out there doing their share. You know, the fact that you're interviewing me about the subject tells me that you care. Mm-hmm. And it's very hopeful for me to have these conversations.
And unfortunately, this particular conversation slowly is coming to its end. But I would like to ask you one or two more questions about how to think about all of this, and who are you actually trying to address? Let me make this more clear as a question. We have talked about your efforts to convince, influence, inform politicians or corporations. We have also talked about the fact that you produce your photos and your content to emotionally impact consumers and just audiences all over the world. And I feel I don't want to be too black and white, but there are these different viewpoints on how we can tackle these massive challenges. Some advocates argue that, of course, even the smallest, poorest, simplest person anywhere in the world can make a difference and change your consumption, change what you buy, what you eat, what you use, whatever. And then people, I don't know, buy an electric car and feel, okay, I think I've done my share now. Others, they become vegans and feel, okay, this is my contribution. And others say, well, no matter what I do, it's not enough. It's a drop in the bucket. What we actually need to do is make a much bigger change on a political, economical, global level. This is where, like in terms of, for example, construction, like we have to transform whole industries. Otherwise, nothing of all of this will really matter.
Yeah, and we have to do it all at the same time.
Probably the answer is all of the above. But
exactly,
I would like to hear you talk about how you, where do you put your own focus in terms of what you try to achieve and which kind of message you try to get across?
It's all of the above, Eric, because we do need to continue influencing the decision makers, and we do that with our vote. Mm-hmm. And that's a power that we all have. I cannot tell anybody who to vote for, and I actually don't care, but showing up at the polls is the first thing. And this year, 50% of the planet is going to elect new officials. So as we elect these people, let's just take a look, you know, casually about how they feel about things like biodiversity and climate, because it'd be useful to survive on this planet to have people who care. And secondly, so it's top down. Keep influencing CEOs and corporations. And, you know, some corporations are doing amazing things, and even small changes have massive impact because these corporations are huge. I work with Sony and have worked with many years. You know, Sony has shifted now. They have no plastic in their packaging for all their equipment anymore. It might seem small, but it adds on so quickly. Yeah. And then from the bottom up, we need to continue to be advocates. You know, the minute you stop caring and you tell other people that you don't care, other people don't care either. And pretty soon nobody cares. So you have to make a personal choice of feeling hopeful and becoming, I call it wearing an invisible superhero suit. You just have to wear it, you know, and every day do something. And the most important thing that we do is our influence on others. Tell others why you care. If it's veganism that gets it done for you, we'll talk about it. If the contribution was to drive less or drive an EV, well, that's an important thing too. It all adds up. The only thing we cannot do is do nothing.
Yeah. Do nothing. Stop caring. Giving up. That's not the option. And you have been on that route of advocacy, of documenting the beauty of nature for quite a while now. You have traveled all over the world to do this work for, I think, more than 30 years now. Document the beauty of nature, of wildlife, of the ocean. I think you visited more than 130 countries, probably even more by now. And of course, that's an impossible question to ask, but I don't want to ask about a favorite moment. But would you share, to wrap this conversation up, would you share one of your favorite moments underwater that you treasure? Maybe a photo that is very meaningful to you and how you captured it, or maybe even a moment without a camera, something where you feel this has been defining for you and the relationship with the underwater world.
You know, there's a lot, but I think anytime you find yourself in the presence of one of the big animals, like the great whales, yeah, and you stop thinking about them as an opportunity for a selfie, right? and more as, yeah, these are our fellow passengers. You know, these animals are traveling with us on spaceship Earth, and they play a role. And we may not know what that role is because we don't belong to their society. We don't speak their language, but they clearly have societies, that nations, you know, that they belong to. And to me, that causes awe and wonder, you know, just to look in the eye of a whale and ask, you know, where has she been? What does she see when she dives, you know, a kilometer into the depths to hunt? How does she do it? Anyway, to me, it's all the majesty and the marvelous amount of nature. But that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this book, Hope.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to share some of these enthusiasm and love for nature, some of these stories about the things that have impacted me. And I wanted to invite people to become part of a community of hopeful people that are picking up each other. You know, when you sing in a choir and, you know, you hear everybody singing and then you have to catch your breath. Well, no, the music doesn't stop. The rest of the people keep singing. And that's the magic of community. So, yeah, hope.
Well, thank you so much for allowing us to be a small part of your community by making the time for this conversation. I really appreciate it. And keep up the work and keep up the hope. We will do the same. Thank you so much.
Thank you for caring, Eric.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.